Don't waste a second coding yet another login registration system. Use Product Structure to dynamically provide your site with turnkey solutions for user engagement, all through a single line of JavaScript. From registration to importing contacts to inviting friends, our products come with a built-in A/B testing engine to ensure you have the best methods to manage your users. Product Structure. Focus on your core application and let us serve you the rest. Don't waste a second coding yet another login registration system. Use Product Structure to dynamically provide your site with turnkey solutions for user engagement, all through a single line of JavaScript. From registration to importing contacts to inviting friends, our products come with a built-in A/B testing engine to ensure you have the best methods to manage your users. Product Structure. Focus on your core application and let us serve you the rest.
Come to Chicago Erlang Factory Light on October 4th and listen to Erlang talks from Alexander Gunaris, Susan Potter, Adam Densberg, Christopher Meckeljohn, Evan Miller, Mahesh Mahalani Subramaya, Garrett Smith, Corey Haynes, Jesse Gum, and Sean Cribbs. Use the discount code MOSTLYERLANG to get a 15% discount when you register on the Erlang Factory website.
Hello, and welcome to episode number 15 of the Mostly Erlang podcast. Today we are talking with Robert Burding, who is one of the creators of Erlang and has done a lot of other interesting stuff on the Erlang virtual machine. And in addition, we have Fred Havare and Brian Hunter, who are among our regulars. So, Robert, can you sort of introduce yourself to people, to the anybody who might not know who you are?
Yeah, hi. I'm Robert Burding. I used to work at the Ericsson Computer Science Lab and was one of the three initial people who started developing Erlang together with Joe Armstrong and Mike Williams. I've worked with one of the first companies outside Ericsson using Erlang, Bluetail, for Swedish military procurement, and now I work for Erlang Solutions.
And you, in addition to doing Erlang, you've done a bunch of other languages on the Beam virtual machine.
I like implementing languages, basically.
Okay, everybody needs a crazy hobby.
Well, it was before it was implementing out doing different implementations of Erlang, but now I've got the Erlang machine. I thought I'd try doing implementing different languages on that, right, instead.
It's a good sport.
Yes, it is. It is.
So, what languages have you implemented on the Erlang virtual machine?
Three proper languages. One's a proper prolog. It's called Erlog. It's a real prolog. It's a subset of the prolog standard. The second one is one that's called Lisp Flavored Erlang. That is more like a front end to Erlang. So I'm an old Lisp person myself, so I thought it'd be fun doing a Lisp on the Erlang machine. But in that case, I decided I would modify the Lisp to suit the Erlang machine. And my third language, which I'm still working on, is implementing Lua on the Erlang machine as well, which I call Lua-L. And that, again, that's a proper Lua implementation. So I tried to make it as Lua-like as possible, everything there.
I have a question,
Can you provide links to all three of those? Just before we go on, can you just provide us with links to all three of those so people can find them on the show notes?
I had a question, Robert. I was curious. So I know that in that cycle of writing a language for the Erlang runtime is you end up producing core Erlang right before it becomes – before you go through the steps in that process to become like the object code. So up above, like as you're doing these transformations, like to come up with this – Now, core Erlang is this text-based thing still that sort of looks a little bit like a skinny version of Erlang, right?
It's basically a simple functional language. It's actually better for compiling than Erlang is.
Well, that makes sense because it's
more regular and
it's more regular. It's simpler. It's like a more standard type functional language. For example, it has variable scoping, which Erlang doesn't. It's just quite a nice, simple language. It's quite decent language to do optimizations on and things like this as well.
When you mention that Erlang is proper. I'm awfully curious about that, because this is something I've been thinking about from other languages coming at, and I've sort of poked around at Elixir a bit and how they go through that cycle, and then I've looked at Lisp Flavored Erlang, but I'm just now sort of getting started in this process, and I'd love to hear what it means to be a proper prologue versus like tailoring the language. Like, what all sort of things would you do on this layer before you become core? You're talking about all the stuff you're doing between whatever you're doing in core Erlang, right?
Yeah. Okay. Well, at the moment, the Erlang's still an interpreter. It's perfectly compilable. I just haven't got that far to do a compiler for it. The difference is that with LFE, and I mean Elixir as well, that those languages are tailored to run on the Erlang system, and they're made to interact with the rest of the Erlang environment. When I was doing the prolog, I decided I would not do that. I would make a proper standard prolog that behaves just like any other prolog does, or supposed to do. And then I would have to do work to make it fit onto the Erlang machine, not just the compiling bit stage, but how it handles memory and how it handles things like logical variables. You have to do that yourself, because there's no direct alternative or mapping for that on the Erlang machine.
So you can't have it. It doesn't interact well with the sort of standard Erlang. You can't just say,
Well, yes and no. I mean, the Erlang, the data types used in the prolog are pretty straightforward in their mapping to Erlang, which means you can quite easily generate calls into the prolog. But you need a sort of, what say, a prolog machine to evaluate it.
So you have a separate bit of executable that's running outside of, like...
No, it's all implemented in Erlang.
Okay.
The whole thing's implemented in Erlang, runs on the Erlang machine. But you just have to... like LFE and Elixir, they map directly onto the Erlang VM. The prolog doesn't. You have to build a layer in between, which runs.
I first heard about Prolog 20 years ago when I was in university. There was a class which I didn't actually end up taking, although my roommate did, as I recall. But I sort of rediscovered it when reading Bruce Tate's book, Seven Languages in 7 Weeks, and he has a specific 20 lines of code. You start looking at it going, where's the program? It's just amazing. And it sort of set me thinking as to, all right, this is something I would use in a very weird set of circumstances, but I could totally imagine those circumstances. Now, if you're running it, I mean, how does it look to the outside Erlang process, other processes in the runtime? Can you send it messages? Can it talk to Manessia tables?
Well, at the moment, it's just, you can run multiple instances of it, but it's just running, just not. From the Erlang point of view, it just looks more like sort of normal code running in an Erlang process.
Okay, but can you interact? Can other things interact with it? Is sort of my question.
They could. I've only written very simple interaction now, but that's just, there's nothing stopping you doing that. There's nothing stopping you. I mean, for example, having prolog predicates that send messages into the Erlang system, or receiving messages, and things like this as well too. There's nothing stopping you doing that. Now I just have a very simple top loop. Basically, a type shell type thing, which like a simple standard prolog shell to do it. But there's nothing stopping you doing that.
Because it would seem like prolog would be a sort of sweet spot for things like a powerful rules engine that you could do there. Or it seems like prolog is sort of ideally suited for two or three, certain classes of problems that would just be sort of really obviously cool.
Yeah. Anything that sort of anything that sort of requires some form of searching in databases or stepping through or having alternate type solutions, Prolog fits very well onto it. And anyway, I think Prolog is just generally quite a nice general programming language. We wrote the first original Erlang interpreter in Prolog, and there's no direct problems doing that.
I'd be curious, I imagine a lot of people listening, and I know just a little bit about, because I've bumped into it just out of chance a few times since I was a kid, funny enough, but with Prolog. But I'd be curious, like, just to have an overview of what all, you know, there's this logic programming side to it. There's the backtracking and all these concepts that aren't really familiar to most people. Could you give us kind of a lesson on?
Yeah, so people who, sorry, I think we're saying the same thing, Brian.
Yeah.
Well, basically, a prolog, program, or what you want to call it, consists of a set of rules. And you can have many rules that have the same, well, not going to call it a function, but the same predicate, the same number of arguments and things like this. And normally, say, if you're running Erlang and you're calling a function, you have a number of clauses in a function. Once a choice is made of a clause through the pattern matching, that's the choice that's made. You can't change it. Prolog, there you have a number of clauses as well for each predicate, and you have the possibility of selecting one clause through unification, and then coming back afterwards and saying, no, I didn't want that one. I'll try another one instead. Okay. So you can generate a fade, and we'll go back and we'll try another clause and see if that works. And then you can step through choices like this. It provides methods of a way of a controlled way of sort of searching through your program space in a sense, I think.
Okay, so that'd be like you're walking, is it sort of like a tree where you'd walk down and say, okay, yeah. I'm at this point, yeah. this point, and you'd say, okay, well, I've hit a fail like five steps beyond. Yeah. I'm going to now walk back to that spot where I could have made another choice. And
yeah, and you can even say, yes, I found a solution, but try giving me another solution instead.
Oh, okay.
Can walk back and do that. I mean, for example, a practical example, you can interface my Erlang, save to Nets table, and you can use it through Prolog backtracking to make selections from the Nets table. I've actually got two examples of interfacing Nets. Both are sort of, there are a number of different ways you can call Erlang from inside Erlang, and I've got examples of doing Nets on both of them.
I've heard of things like the Einstein's riddle, that kind of thing as being like this perfect place for things like Prolog, where you set your series of constraints and then magic happens and then your answer pops out. And I've heard people describe Erlang as it's the part of Prolog without the magic box. and so that part of the magic box, I think, is really, really foreign to a lot of us. And most of us coming through, that are listening, know Erlang to a degree. And, we imagine, okay, Erlang is like Prolog with these other things, but then you talk to Prolog developers and they're like, no, it's not. And I'd love to hear, because you're in a great perch to tell us, like what parts of Erlang are Prolog like, and which ones are just like a Prolog developer is going to look at you like you're crazy if you say that. Yeah.
Most of Erlang is not
Prolog. Okay. All right. First myth. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a bit of syntax. I mean, some of the Prolog syntax is still there. And a few ways of writing things are quite, well, sort of Prolog-y.
Would that be the function heads or like the function heads?
And Erlang's use of semicolon. That's all very Prolog-y.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking I just posted a link to the chat here of Sudoku solver for Prolog. And it's, as an Erlang programmer, you can look at it and, it kind of looks, you can understand it, but I wouldn't say it looks like Erlang. it looks enough like Erlang that I can look at it and go, okay, I sort of understand. I mean, and I know just enough about Prolog to know what's going on.
One of the big differences will be unification in Prolog. Pretty much any variable can be used both as an input or an output, depending on what you know at that time. This is something that if you use Erlang that has something more functional, you just expect that the input and the output are going to be different things.
Right. It's sort of the opposite of asking where you have very...
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the things that went when we moved from Prolog to Erlang. unification became pattern matching instead. And pattern matching, as Fred says, is one directional, whereas unification is bidirectional. So the unification, you don't have a concept of a pattern and data. They're both data, both patterns.
Yeah, Prolog. I've played with LFE a little bit, and it doesn't seem nearly as radical as our log.
No.
In terms of
it wasn't designed to be. It was just it was designed to map directly onto the Erlang machine.
It's just Lispy syntax for Erlang, basically.
It's Lispy syntax for Erlang. It gives you macros and all the other nice goodies you want from a Lisp environment.
Is Erlang,
but basically it's Erlang.
Is Erlang still under development? Are you still playing with it? What's the status of it?
Yeah. It's reached a state. I mean, it all works. It reached a state. It needs a sort of a more serious user so you can do more constructive work on it.
Right.
So now it works. So now you can write programs in Erlang. I'm going to try the Sudoku later and see how that one works. And you can write programs in it. And you can run them from Erlang. You can interface them to Erlang and call in a certain sense, call them from Erlang and have Erlang calling them. But it needs more work in improving the interface. But to do that, it also needs someone who actually has requirements for it.
Right.
I'm wondering, like, so you said, you have the work against the ETS table. And so that makes me think about this natural thing of being able to chunk through data, and gets me thinking then about the distributed side of Erlang, of hooking up multiple nodes here. If you have these Erlang things, does this have a, how would you see this in that whole, MapReduce kind of crawling across big data kind of space, or how does this tie in, or what would this possibly skin? What cat would this skin in that? Or not really?
I don't think so. No, not okay. Not really. Okay. You could, yeah.
I'm also noticing
perhaps in the reduce phase in that sense.
Okay.
I'm also noticing that the latest commits in the Erlang repo are okay in the develop branch. They're much more recent, but in the master branch, they seem like they're several years ago.
Yeah, that's as I said. I mean, it's not dead in any sense. It's just that to do anything more sensible, now, I need more input on requirements.
Right.
I've done a bit of work explaining the develop branch. And when there's something really worthwhile, I'll move it across to the master branch.
Does it compile with rebar?
Probably not. Oh, well, I haven't tried, to be honest. I haven't tried.
So if somebody wants to try that, should they send you a pull request?
Do that. If someone can modify the makefile and have some rebar configs, I'd be happy to have it. And I'll try them and add them.
The source here would be, you'd have these PL files, and you would then, so if someone were pulling this down, your repo, they'd pull down and then they'd look at the examples and they'd see something like the, like homer.pl or, the fleck.pl. And then they would they be inside of the Erlang shell to do this, or
you can run it from either. I've made it
from the console. So you'd do like Erl C and or okay.
Well, you don't compile them. You the easiest way is either to call the right functions in the Erlang system to load them into the Erlang database, or you can run them from a standard type Prolog shell.
Which is the ETS demo? Is it one of these or?
It's called Erlang ETS. It's in the source directory. There are two. It's called in Erlang ETS is one. That is more lower level into the system. And there is another one in, let's see. Let's see if we can find it now. The second one.
By the way, if anybody wants, shout out if anybody wants to, you know, do cool tutorials or something else for this. I'd love for one would love to read it, and I'm sure Robert would love to see it too.
Yeah, there's another file called Erlang demo, which is just a demonstration of how you can call Erlang functions from inside the Erlang system, and one of them just calls is an ETH call just to generate a list of all the keys in the current ETH system.
So yeah, it sounds like it would be really useful though to. If you could,
yeah. If you have some form of problem where you want to step through the database, make search into this database and scan through it, not just get one solution or all the solutions, but to be able to step through and get solutions as they come, then it fits very well into the Prolog way of looking at the world, right?
Mm. Right. I mean, I actually had a problem that there was an idea we had that a while back that was. Would have fit perfectly for Prolog, which was, I was talking to some people about building an app to do, help plan a dinner party.
Mm.
And if you're cooking, you know, for 20 people in the standard home kitchen, you know, it sort of takes a certain amount of planning on the theory of, okay, this takes an hour and a half to cook it. It has to come out of the oven at this point. So, you know, if you sort of have a constraint of, what has to be sort of warm, what can be reheated, you know, what has to go in the oven, into which the oven or stovetop when, you can sort of work backwards, and I think that might work.
Mm. This is basically a scheduling problem, which is, a well-known example that schools and universities use when teaching Prolog as something it's very good at.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure I could go and find some examples. That appear to be a great, if I ever actually implemented it, it would be a great tool to use to learn Prolog.
Are you familiar with Lindo? It was a language, like a linear programming language. It was one that was ideal for us solving things like the soup problem or it's basically that same thing. It's like we have so many, you know, we have this amount of potatoes, no more and no less, and the price of potatoes is this, and we have to have so much meat, and you have all these constraints, and then you end up with these several points that end up being your, you know, those answers will end up being your best answers, depending on what you're trying to maximize and minimize for and so on. So there's soup, and then there's traveling salesman and you know, series of things like that. That is the space, right? The Erlang would be aimed at.
Yeah. I think if you plan to use it seriously, say in a larger Erlang system, it would be when you want these more complex search algorithms you want to do. I mean, doing Erlang, yes, you can do this in Erlang, of course, but then you have to do everything explicitly, and you can do backtracking in Erlang. It just becomes more complex.
Well, I think
especially if you want to add more control over to how it works.
I think this comes down to a corollary of Greenspun's 10th law that, you know, in this case, any sufficiently complex rule system includes a slow, buggy implementation of half of Prolog.
Yeah.
So why not just use Prolog? It's there. It works.
And so in here, since you have written this, I'd be interested to hear how the process of writing the backtracker was, and how did you model that in Erlang, or where you're converting? Is that a series of processes then that you just?
It's basically, you keep a list of things that are to be done.
Okay.
And you keep a stack of where you've been.
Okay.
So if you fail, you fall back into the stack and pick the stack of choice points, it's called. So you go to the next choice point, then you take the next selection there, and you move forward, you throw away all the things you didn't do, and then you keep going from there, and we'll start again, right?
So it's basically a depth first search of a tree, is what you're saying.
It's a depth first search of a tree, yes.
Okay.
It provides you with a bit of control over what to search and what not to search. As well too.
And does it just run in one Erlang process?
Yeah, it runs in one Erlang process. It could be parallelized. I mean, there probably still are parallel Prologs, but I just never got that far in doing it. That's about as far as I got, actually.
Yeah, I would imagine that for many things, you know, it could be very useful without being parallelized beyond the level of
Beyond
the level of you may have four or five instances of it running at once, but they're not talking to each other particularly.
Mm. In that sense, I mean, if you have a bigger application running many things concurrently and they're using the Erlang for part of it, of course you can just run them all in parallel like the normal Erlang processes if they're independent of each other. If they are dependent, you could have them say you could have one Erlang process where you send requests to which then processes as they come.
Yeah.
Doing a proper parallel prolog is starting to get more work.
Yeah.
To do that.
So we talked about LFE a little bit. What we didn't talk about is Lua. So I don't know anything about Lua. I mean, I've heard the name. I've heard it mentioned a few times. Can you tell us what is Lua? Why would when and where should you use it? And you know, what was your inspiration for porting it to Erlang?
A lot of game people use it for some reason too.
Yeah, use Lua. I was just saying it's quite common in the gaming world as a scripting language.
Yeah, because it's basically easy to embed in C. It's been part of the core design of the language that you can just embed the language.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, if you look in the Lua manual, quarter of the manual is the C interface.
Okay.
So, yes, it's made to interface into say, a major C program. And I know one reason they use in the gaming world is just so they don't have to avoid recompiling and relinking the whole game every time they make small changes in levels, things like that. They just do that in Lua. It's a problem. That's a problem we don't have in Erlang. I mean, we just recompile one module, but they would have to relink the whole thing.
Yep. Yeah, you can imagine the Haskell guys doing the same thing. You know, you got a big program during GHC over it.
Yeah.
And I imagine it's garbage collected and all that, so that they would probably have less fear of throwing out something without all the review and everything, right?
It's quite a nice little language. I mean, from an Erlang point of view, it's very different. It's quite a nice little language. It's relatively simple. It's relatively straightforward. And most of it's quite consistent as well, too. And originally, I was just looking for a language where you had mutable data.
They're truly mutable, not like shadowing, like you would have in other languages that are up on the Erlang runtime. Is that right?
This is pure, truly mutable data. Their basic data type is a table, the key value table, and you can go in and you can modify those tables, and the changes are seen everywhere. It's truly mutable data.
And how do you model that? Is that a series of processes that are basically holding,
it's a big array containing dictionaries and arrays.
Okay.
So you have to carry around a global state and make all the modifications in the global state.
So this is where Joe says you wanted a banana, but you got the gorilla in the
yeah, you got that. Well, it's not too much gorilla, but
it's on purpose.
It's on purpose. Yes,
actually asked for the gorilla.
Yeah. I need a jungle, and my easiest way of doing that is grabbing this banana.
Yeah.
And look, it comes with a gorilla.
Yeah. But it's quite a nice little language. I was originally thinking of doing JavaScript, but that's quite a complex language when you start looking at it.
When you said that it's a regular language and that would be the real issue with JavaScript is it's just such a, you know, such a mess kind of with the truthy this and the, you know, the,
yeah,
and just, and the, the and watts.
When you start looking at it, it's quite a big language in one sense. And it really is a much simpler language.
If you were to simply take the Doug Crockford's, you know, JS Lint compatible subset of it, that's a little better, but it's still a pretty big language.
Yeah. And in that sense, Lua was pretty simple.
Gotcha.
And Lisp is probably also pretty simple, as I recall.
Well, yeah.
With the Lisp flavored Erlang, I think. Wonder about there is the timing, and were you ever tempted to when Clojure was kind of kicking off of saying, "Hey, I'll put my shoulder to the wheel," and because initially there was this Didn't Rich Hickey, he was looking to initially looked at having it on the .NET, on the CLR, on the .NET stack, and on the Java stack, and then just got tired of just got tired of supporting both sides. But it seems like that would have really been an interesting story to have had closure. And it seems like it could still be an interesting story. I was talking to some folks at Lambda Jam about this, and they were all fired up after hearing Joe's keynote. And so so they're probably off building it right now while we're talking.
But by the way, if anybody out there is building closure on the Erlang VM and you'd like to announce it here in the podcast, please get in touch.
Yeah. I was just going to see if that's one that Robert had looked at or thought about or.
No, actually, I started LFV quite a while back. It's been on and off work for quite a while. Mm-hmm. I had the goal from the very beginning that this would be a version of Lisp that fitted directly onto the Erlang VM in all ways. I mean, it would use all the features that the Erlang VM provides and not trying to do anything which the Erlang VM can't do, like mutable data. So, for example, I mean, pattern matching is built into LFE in the same way as it is in Erlang, and it's used just as much to do that. So that was the major goal of the language. It was designed for the VM, for the Erlang VM. I mean, in much the same way that Clojure is designed for the JVM.
Right, or Scala.
And I think one of the benefits of using Clojure on the JVM is the fact that you have all this JVM stuff there as well, right?
Yeah. I mean, the JVM, for all that we, complain about it, whatever, get frustrated by it, does have a lot of powerful features to it that are very compelling. You know, like the fact that you can write anything from a cell phone to an IBM Z mainframe, pretty much everything in between. I don't know that anyone's ported Erlang to run on. No, has anybody ported Erlang to run on a mainframe? I'm curious. I'm not sure it would be particularly useful. I don't know
if anyone's done that.
Erlang on a mainframe?
I know there's an Erlang on VMS port.
The open VMS. Yeah, I remember hearing a talk on that. Seems like a lot of pain.
Yeah, for an operating system that's basically dying, has been dying, sort of going away.
The justification on that one is interesting, and it turns they were saying that their customers were leaving because they didn't have Rabbit. And they needed to have Rabbit for them to stay with OpenVMS. And so that was the roundabout. It's like, okay, well, we'll build Erlang then on the OpenVMS. I think that's the story, which is just like, wow, that's a...
Yeah.
Why not?
Yeah. Now, that's why, in one sense, I would think it'd be a bit strange running Clojure on Erlang.
Okay.
Just because the language is more designed to fit into the JVM.
Yeah, the JVM has a very different execution model than the...
Well,
are we calling it the BVM or the Beam? I don't know.
Well, that initial, the initial goes of it, it was there for, on the .NET, on the CLR, and on, I guess it's probably become more, has more of the Java stuff around now than it did at the initiation, but that's the way I understand it. And I'm, of course, no Clojure expert, but I have a bunch of Clojure friends that are always, trying to lure me over. I'd like to turn them over to Erlang and say, you just run this, you be my buddy on the Erlang runtime. That's what I'd like.
Well, I mean, if I was to write something on the JVM, Clojure would definitely be an alternative I'd look at.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Depending what client or customer accept, right?
Yeah.
Because
either that or Scala, which I. On the shelf behind me somewhere.
The Clojure folks, that community is very, there's a very sharp community there. They're always adding new neat bits that are really helpful. And I think that there's some things in the way that it's probably worthwhile looking at the Ruby community to steal some things about the way their community works. It's probably also good to look over at the Clojure community and see what they're doing, because they're always coming up with frameworks that are very And we could steal some more of that from them. That'd be good.
Oh, yeah. Now my next goal is to look at Elixir and see what I can steal from that.
Right.
So, yeah, see what ideas I can take from there as well, too.
You know, I mean, it'll be interesting is and I don't know how much it'll probably be lower, but, you know, like, for example, Python has been ported to run as Ruby on the JVM. I suspect it would be more difficult because of the mutable variables and other things to get them to run on Erlang, but, you know, it'd be an interesting idea. But
it would be, yeah.
You know, I suspect the thing is, not really being an interesting thing, that the JVM maps much closer to sort of a traditional runtime, you know, with mutable variables and sort of Unix-like processes than the Erlang runtime, which tends to be
A little different. I think that's one reason, for example, why the concurrency primitives in Clojure look like they do. You have all these options which can be mapped onto the JVM quite well.
Right. I mean, the thing is, as you say, the Clojure runtime primitives need to support They need to support the JVM or the .NET runtime. And the thing is, you know, the nature of your runtime depends a lot, you know, determines a lot about your language. It's the abstraction comes through. I mean,
I think if you were to implement Clojure on the Erlang VM, and if it couldn't access all the rest of, say, OTP, I don't think it would be worth it.
Yep.
Then you'd have to rewrite everything. I mean, that was one of the goals of LFE, just to be able to mesh perfectly into the whole Erlang environment. I mean, same thing with Elixir. It has exactly the same goal. You can write your module in LFE or Elixir and just run together with everything else, and there's no problems doing it.
Yeah, I mean, even the Django template language for Erlang, which I use a little bit, you know, it takes your template and it renders it, it compiles it down to a module, and then you just call the render method on your template, on the module, and it, you know, spits out an IO list that is the rendered template. Do whatever you're going to do with an IO list. So that's, you know, that's some stuff in it. But, you know, it basically is a templating language that compiles down to a beam file, which is really nice because you can...
And that's what I mean, at least in my opinion anyway. I mean, that Clojure is designed to fit into the JVM. In that case, I don't think it'd probably fit very well into the Erlang.
Yeah, I suspect you could make it work. You could do it if you forced it, but it's, you know, sort of a very...
The question is,
would you still call it Clojure if you'd forced it that much?
that's the thing. Is it still Clojure?
You might as well start with Doxer or LFE and be done with it.
Yeah.
There's also a scheme to the Erlang virtual machine. I don't really know much about it. And unfortunately, he's in Japan, which makes the time zone problems for this podcast rather tricky. But we will somehow get him on sooner or later.
I mean, then you have to decide what modifications you're going to make to the language. So, I mean, I decided for LFE, I would change the Lisp. It's not common Lisp. It's not Scheme. It's something that fits directly onto the Erlang VM. And I wouldn't try to implement features that didn't mesh. If you want to take pure Scheme, there are things there that would be very difficult to mesh.
F-sharp started because somebody suggested they port Haskell to the CLR. And realized the CLR and Haskell are just very different concepts of types that just weren't going to fit together.
That's one feature of F sharp is that it works together with everything else on the CLR.
F sharp seems like it has some nice features, but it seems to me the predominant reason you would want to use sharp is because you want a ML style functional language that works on the CLR and can work with CLR stuff.
Some people are looking at it as too, it's like a, you know, it it's this ML that learned, you know, in the same way that, you know, you could look at C sharp or Java is like, they look a little like C, but they learned some things that they didn't want to do. And so it's just a little bit more modern. So it would be another.
By the time this airs, Brian recorded an episode on F sharp. It's episode number 13, and it was two episodes back. So if you haven't listened to it, you want to know more about F sharp, go take a listen.
One of the things we pitched in that conversation was the idea of targeting F sharp to the Erlang runtime, and the folks on that podcast they're pretty interested in that idea because they're both F sharp developers primarily, but they also spend some time in Erlang and we're kind of kicking around just different ways of approaching that and trying not to lose the advantage of where you can tap into the other side, like you're talking about mm-hmm. Clojure not being able to tap into Java would be sort of a shame. And so we're mm-hmm. trying to look at how you preserve both sides of that. So on the one side, you compile down to a Beam file and you get all mm-hmm. the advantages of cheap processes and distribution, but then trying to figure out some way of having like a shim layer that also was part of your compile cycle that would be native mono or native, CLR, down on that side. And you'd have basically, a port driver or something, just trying to figure out what sort of Frankenstein makes sense on the thing. And if you could come out with something that was attractive or if it would just be an abomination.
It seems to me that a better abstraction would be to have another language, be it F sharp or something else, basically act like a separate Erlang node, and it could have sort of something that would all to Erlang look like processes, or gen servers, genfsms or whatever, that you could have a gen, something that looks to Erlang like a gen server.
Yeah,
sitting open F sharp, and then there's some impedance level. And when you send it messages, they get bridged into the F sharp world.
The sort of the J interface or the OTP.NET sort of path there, and that exists. It's just not really very satisfying, at least not on the .NET side.
There are a number of Lua interfaces that do exactly the same thing.
Oh, they can. Which of the two? The exact same as which?
I think it's called. I can't remember the name of them. I think one's called eLua. I can't remember the names of them now, but they're both on, but they're on GitHub anyway. But they run they run at Lua in a separate operating system process and just use user port to send requests backwards and forwards from them.
Okay, so the initial idea, what I was talking about with F sharp, that model exists for Lua. Yeah. Okay, that's a really good one for me to note. Okay, cool. And I was thinking at first you might be saying that it was the J interface equivalent or the OTP. Okay, cool.
No, there's. I think one of the problems of doing you would have of doing F sharp directly in Erlang is how you map the data types. So you get a useful mapping.
Yeah, it would seem to me that if you were to try to map, an F sharp or Haskell, what you'd end up with is types would map to tagged tuples, where you just have an atom in the first position to designate the type.
Well, you think about the model with things like CoffeeScript or with TypeScript. You do have these things that are they're strongly typed at that level.
Obviously,
at compile time they're strongly typed at that level, but then they compile down to JavaScript, which is is Wild West, and so you might get some of the same benefits, and then have the. It'd be really interesting if you get some of the same benefits, but then this thing that's notoriously tricky about like trying to have hot code loading on anything other than the Erlang runtime mm-hmm. or to try to,
Is any other language actually support anything vaguely similar to Erlang hot code loading?
Can't you do it on the JVM through some package that provides it? I can't remember the name. People say that to me, that you can do that on the JVM. I have never used it, so I don't know anything about it.
I've heard people make the same claim on the .NET side, and it turns out they just didn't understand what hot code loading in Erlang was. And so I don't know. I mean, maybe they really do have something like that on the Java side, but the things I've heard people say, oh, we can do that, is like, no, that's not the same thing. And then I'd show them what it was in Erlang, and they're like, oh, you're right, that's not the same thing.
they're like,
how do you do that?
Really,
how the hell does that work?
Impress somebody is to just have a running process, and you're like, yeah, so we have this process. It's spitting out data. We can't take it down. We need to fix a bug. Here, we show you how to do this in Erlang. Boom, boom, boom. You're done. And they're just like,
yeah.
You do?
I mean, a lot of languages allow you to load code dynamically, but most of them haven't defined actually what happens if you're running that code in the middle of it.
I think
Lisp systems allow you to recompile or load in a function. What happens if you're in the middle of someone's actually using that function? That's not really well defined.
JavaScript does the same thing. I mean, you can load code at any time in JavaScript in a browser. You can also go into the Firebug or Chrome console and, cut and paste code in and do all sorts of cool things, which is occasionally very useful. I've done that where, taking a function, a file that does not exist on our production server yet because it hasn't made it there, but I need it on production, now. All right, copy, go open file in editor, copy file, open Firebug, paste file, use code. I do not recommend this, but you can do it.
Yeah.
Hope nothing blows up.
Back onto my head's turned back to Prolog now because I'll be thinking of all sorts of things tonight. It's like, why didn't I ask? Why didn't I ask about that? But on the Prolog, so one of the things that can is this true? You can have, if you define your constraints a certain way, you might have some program that runs for, a million years. Is that the case, or is that a myth? Okay.
It can just keep on searching.
Okay.
It's the halting problem,
Yeah. If you've written a very bad search algorithm, it can take a very long time before it finds a solution.
Because these combinatorial things that can, it could find the answer, but now will you get early results back about? See, this is one of the things I was thinking about is if you had message passing, so you're on, Erlog here, and you're going through, you could be passing messages out of saying, well, here's an answer that's, a candidate. Is that something you're doing, or is that?
I don't do it through message passing, but yes, you ask it something, and it will go and either say no, it couldn't work it out, or say yes, here's a solution.
Okay.
And then you can say, okay, good, I'm happy with that. Or I can say, you can tell it, give me another solution.
Okay.
And then it'll go back and give you another solution and return with that. And you can also ask it, give me all solutions as well, too, of course.
This is like the general and the hills problem, right?
So you have the option of doing that.
I would think you could combine, I'm just sort of thinking off the top of my head, a Prolog with something like a proper or quick check to do some very cool testing stuff, but I don't know how you would do that. You can't make a good dissertation for something. But I'm thinking, if you're using something like a dialyzer, one of the quick check type things where you could use Prolog to sort of create some constraints around your code and do really cool static analysis, but I'm not enough of a computer science theory geek to even know where to start with that. Somebody is there.
I think you probably could. I think you probably could, because I reckon you're doing some form of searching there when you're generating alternatives. But again, I'm with you here. I'm not an expert in that field at all, so I'm just guessing.
It seems like if you've got this tree that you're walking up and down, and that seems like a really natural model for distributing across many, many servers. In Erlog, you're running as a single process, but you're also a single process on a single machine, right? Or is it?
Single process on a single machine.
That seems really like a fruitful area to extend the thing into, that thing of saying, if you had a Prolog problem that was, big and chunky, but you could spin this thing across 1,000 servers and
you could definitely do it in such a way you could define some predicates and say, when I'm trying to find a solution here, try running these alternatives in parallel,
right?
And just get back, give me the solutions as they come.
I mean, it sounds like basically what Erlog needs is somebody who's either a grad student or let's use it for a project to just take it on and
So far it's mainly been sort of I'm doing it for my own sort of more or less personal enjoyment, but now it's got to the stage that if it's going further, it needs actually someone to use it to come back with feedback, with realistic feedback on how it can be used.
Has anybody actually used it for in a production system anywhere?
Not that I know of. But then again, I mean, I know people looked at it, but as far as I know, no one's used it. It has a few limitations as well. I mean, if you have a really big Prolog database that's not very well done at the moment, it can be improved. But then again, it's something that you need users to actually come back with feedback.
Right.
On what works and what doesn't work, but this is slow, this is not good, or whatever it might be, so you can attack those problems.
Yeah, I'm, like I said, I think I may have some constraint-related things coming up in my project sooner or later, so maybe I'll pull it out.
Well, that's one thing I've been wanting to add to it, is constraint logic. There are a number of prologues which do contain constraint logics. So,
is there a good introductory book, preferably free online, on Prolog?
Free online, I don't know. I've got sort of the old classic books.
Yeah. Maybe we need somebody to
I could probably find, I could definitely look at them if they're, I don't know if they're free online. But,
I could probably
find them. I have the old classic books, and I've got to say the Prolog standard book and things like this, which I'm working on. But yeah. It's when you start getting into it, it is a very different language. I mean, if you think Erlang is different, you haven't hit Prolog yet.
Yeah, well, this is one of the reasons I kind of want to play with it is because, you know, if I'm learning a new language, I want to learn something that's radically different. You know, as I always say, if you know Java and then go learn C#, you really haven't learned a new language, learned something radically different, or going from
Prolog.
Ruby to Python and back. You know, it's like... Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, you could sort of, these are not the same language per se, but they're not really different.
No.
Whereas if you're going from Java to Erlang or Haskell or Erlang to R, you know, you're getting a very different type of thing.
Yeah, they're completely different. And logic languages like Prolog are different from the others as well. You can program them more or less as a standard. You can almost write standard functions in them if you want to, but then you're sort of wasting it away in a sense, right?
Right. I mean, you know, why would you do that?
It seems. Yeah. Yeah.
I have a link that I'll send along with the show. A library called Bumblebee. It's this artificial bee colony algorithm. There's a version of it. Matthias Brandewinder has this Bumblebee project out on CodePlex, but it'd be awfully interesting to see what that looks like in Erlog. But it's a series of things like, you know, traveling salesmen and so on that are implemented there. But just seeing each one of those come across. But the artificial bee colony one is pretty fun. You know, like how they work, like how they know to keep on going to this same spot. That's how does the bee know to go to the pollen or to look for another route? Like that one's all dried up. And
yeah, that'd be very interesting to see how that works.
I'll send that. I think you'd get a kick out of this, and you'll probably do something brilliant with it.
Yeah, if it works, I'll put it into my examples page as well too.
With the sort of underlying thing across all these about the Erlang runtime being, you know, the thing that all these languages are targeting here, I'm curious about the SD Erlang project and what's coming out of that.
What's the SD Erlang project for those who might not
know? This is the thing. I mean, well, Robert could probably tell a lot better than me, but I'll give the ham-fisted thing, and then he can fill. But it's like this research project, the EU and the Sweden in particular, but basically has invested in this 3-year project to say, let's build an Erlang runtime that will work reliably and easily to 100,000 cores.
Right, that's the mega like, project we had.
Like 100.
Episode 14 is about that.
Okay, great.
We'll explain it for those who might not have heard, you know, who might not have caught that, listened to that episode yet. So, but.
Let me just hush, and then I'll let Robert fill in the silence.
Well, as you say, it's looking at the problem of if you have a large number of cores or a large number of machines, how do you get Erlang running on those? I mean, the Erlang distribution mechanism won't support thousands of machines today. It's sort of, there's the limits in hundreds, don't know, I've had everything from 100 to 200 or something like this, different machines. The distribution mechanism won't support that more properly anyway.
That's without getting into the global group stuff, right?
Yeah. Okay. So then you get the problem of, okay, how do we modify Erlang, modify the Erlang runtime so it can do that? So I can run thousands of machines running Erlang in one distributed net, or running on lots of cores, or how you balance and trade off things like this for it. And that's what the EU project is looking at.
For language designers like you that are building these things, is there any will it still be this thing that would, as long as you can compile down to core Erlang, you're A-okay on this, or is this something where you're?
Well, so far I've actually avoided going too deep into the machine.
Okay.
To do that. Again, because then it's starting to get quite complex in your language now. So now I've just kept it at the basic Erlang level.
Yep.
And if you're running multiple processors running any of these, then you'll get the same features as you would any other Erlang process.
Okay, cool.
So, but I mean, you could do a lot of special things there if you wanted to. But then it's another level of complexity for that.
Yep.
And therefore, then I'm sort of wondering if it's, it might not be too much just to have this private project as well, too. Well, one of my dreams is doing a new Erlang implementation, but I think that's just too much work. Really,
which part of it would be the runtime part? Are you thinking about the language level or like
the emulator, like, the runtime?
Okay.
As I said, I enjoy implementing languages, and I mean, there's nothing wrong with the Beam as such, and I don't think I could make a better version of it. But maybe it would be fun to say trying to make to do an Erlang implementation for a specific use, say a very tiny Erlang.
Well, they,
how small can I make Erlang?
They have the Erlang on Zen project. They're hopefully going to launch in a couple of months, where they basically built an Erlang runtime to run on, run on the raw hypervisor.
Yeah.
Mostly EC2, I guess. They're going to be on the show in October-ish.
Okay.
Where the goal is really that you want to run on the hypervisor directly without, you know, Linux or something else in between. Mm-hmm. And I don't really know much about it. I'm going to,
I think
come back in 2 months, everybody, and we'll find out.
Yeah. I think it's still a modification of the basic Beam. But then again, I'll be back in 2 months to hear more about that.
All right, so guys, we should we're getting sort of, it's been about an hour, so I just want to do announcements, and then we should get to picks and then head out, getting kind of late.
Yeah.
So a couple of announcements. Yeah. First of all, Erlang Factory Lights coming up September 14th, which should be real soon after you hear this. Will be Erlang Factory Light New York. That's a Saturday, and Joe Armstrong will be there. Robert, you'll be there.
Yeah, I'm there.
Fred will be there, although he just dropped off the call. Mahesh will be there. A bunch of other people will be good. Looks like an exciting thing. October 4th will be in Chicago. Looks like some Garrett Smith, Mahesh will be there, Alexander Granares, some other really good people. On October 16th,
October 11th
and
12th.
Yeah. We'll just do the Erlang Factory Lights. We'll get the other ones in.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right.
Will be the 16th will be Berlin. Stefanovsky, Pablo Baron. Just looking through this, Robert, you'll be there as well.
Probably. I'm not quite certain, but I think I will be.
It says you and Joe may well be there. Stefanovsky, Pablo Baron, a bunch of other people. Andrew Stone. And then finally, October 23rd. Will be Erlang Factory Light Tel Aviv. Come enjoy the lovely Mediterranean, Tel Aviv. We have a beautiful event on the Erlang on the Google campus. Erlang campus, yeah, we don't have one of those. We have a Google campus. And the Tel Aviv Erlang Factory Light is free. It is a free event. We've just finished the list of speakers. Myself will be speaking. Alexander Folk from Ubu. Michael Snoyman, who wrote the ESOD package for Haskell, will be speaking. Andy Oram, who's an editor at O'Reilly Media, will be there. Svi Abraham will be there. A bunch of others. Should be some good stuff. That'll be a good one. In addition, Brian, you're going to be at Strange Loop, right?
Oh, you're right. Yeah, I'll be speaking at Strange Loop on September 20th, giving a talk on CQRS with Erlang.
Cool. Strange Loop is one of those conferences I've always meant to get to, and they keep scheduling it against Jewish holidays. last year was the day before Yom Kippur.
I know what Strange Loop is.
Strange Loop is sort of a multilingual conference in St. Louis that tends to be scheduled against Jewish holidays.
It's Alex Miller, the fellow behind Lambda Jam and mm-hmm. Closure West. That's his, I guess, the flagship conference that he runs, the Strange Loop, and it's each year in St. Louis. And you just hear amazing stuff out of it. It's not particularly angled at functional or any particular language. It's just, you know, whatever is really the most interesting thing going on right now. And so it's a good one.
What was it? Gerald J. Sussman of MIT gave a really good talk the last year, the year before. They put all the videos up on InfoQ, so those of us can't quite make
okay.
Scheduling issues. And then, of course, you have Erlang Camp. Amsterdam is sold out, but Nashville's coming up.
Yes. Erlang Camp Nashville will be October 11th and 12th. That's a Friday and Saturday, and it's going to be in a great venue. I've checked it out. It's very comfortable, and the projection's good. The sound, everything's great. Nashville's a fun town, and tickets are super cheap for Erlang Camps. If they're $125 for early bird, and I think $150 for like if you the day before sort of things. And so I think we have about 20 tickets left, I think we had about 30 tickets the last time we had a checkpoint, but I think I've heard people since then. I think we're around to about 20 left, and so by the show, you better sign up.
There are also, if people have announcements they'd like us to throw in, conferences, other things, please send them over. And the final thing I was going to say, final announcement, which I've made before a little bit. We now have a show now has a voicemail box. If you find Mostly Erlang on Skype and leave us voicemail, and it's something interesting and the audio quality is not terrible, then we will play it during the show and talk about it. And you may even get some swag. We're still working on that part, but I'm hoping there will be swag. there'll be swag. There may be swag. That's sort of everything for today. In terms of that, do we have any picks? Anybody have any cool links to share? I'm kind of out this week.
I have a blog post that I ran across. It was from May 27th, but I just bumped into it this past week. It's pretty neat. It's a resource discovery in Erlang, and it's talking about resource discovery, and then it digs into the GPROC library by Ulf Weiger. So it's a good post. I'll give a link to it. It's worth a read. Neat stuff.
There is an LFE page on GitHub, not the site, not the the sources, but there's an on LFE GitHub.io. I think I can get that link out.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I think I've seen that. It's a fun thing.
Yeah.
By the way,
that which is not done by me, okay, that's done by a guy called Duncan McGregor from Rackspace, who got interested. So that is all his work. So that's not my work.
Cool. The other thing I would say is, if people out there are doing cool things with Erlang, and would like to come on the show, please let me know. Be warned, we're booked way out into advance. we're basically booked into December at this point.
Oh, cool. Nice job.
Okay.
Yeah. So, if you're doing something cool and you want to talk about it, you want to tell the world about it, please let us know and we will get you in somehow. Because, like I said, I've always said, this is partially about building community. All right, guys. I think that's it for today.
Well, thanks, Robert. This is a real treat to get to talk to you. And
yeah, it was fun. I enjoyed it. It was
good. All right, guys. Next episode will be with Costas. We're going to record that on Thursday. And we're going to talk about types and dialyzer and lots of other cool stuff like that.